Anyone with a question or a contribution? Yeah.
You touched on the question of language. What about the religion?
Yeah, well, I think earlier on saying that whilst there has been people from different points of view, there's certainly been people calling themselves socialists who speak Russian, who are of the belief that you can't really ever have socialism until you all speak Russian. And I don't want to shock anybody, but implicitly I have comrades in the Socialist Party of Great Britain who have sometimes implicitly sort of indicated to me that anybody who doesn't speak English doesn't stand too much of a chance of becoming a bona fide 100% socialist. All I'm saying is that whilst I touch on these aspects, I don't see language as a problem, as a barrier to socialism. I think that the factors making for socialism won't be impeded by language differences, and in fact the attainment of socialism will give scope to reverse the process of the elimination of minority languages for reasons of the market and state control. But in the case of religion, on the contrary, I don't see that as a question that's carried forward into socialism, because I don't believe that socialism as we understand it can be established consciously and democratically unless without part of the process of that consciousness and of that growth of democracy in the working class movement will be the rejection by workers of religious beliefs. Now, I appreciate it's not as simple as that, in the sense, and I thought I was showing in a shorthand sort of way how it's not quite as simple as that, because I mentioned how amongst my good and excellent comrades in Belfast, I was aware of difference of personality and style and manner between my socialist comrades, who had no religious beliefs, who wanted to abolish all frontiers, even Irish ones, of their respective religious backgrounds. And only the other day I was discussing in another context the way that amongst the socialists in this party, those of a Jewish background, that happens to be my background, have differed with each other as to the extent or significance of that background. I was fascinated in a discussion I heard yesterday, bearing in mind what is often ascribed to Jews, that two fellow socialists of great esteem, who were discussing with each other yesterday lunchtime, both discovered for the first time to their mutual amazement that they were of Jewish background. That's interesting, because it's supposed to be self-evident to everybody. But the fact is, between me and you, it was self-evident to everybody, but then I mention this point to show that no member of this party has any religious beliefs. No member of this party has any beliefs in national solutions. So they couldn't be a Zionist or a Jewish believer in this party. But nevertheless, history, social conditions, and all these things have shaped certain people where, to a greater or less extent, features, traits, attitudes, behavior could be meaningfully ascribed to their particular religious path. I've given the Irish example. So clearly, it would be simplistic to wholly eliminate those sort of differences. Nevertheless, it's the view of this party, and I uphold it and believe it to be valid and practical, that you won't get socialism till workers have shed their religious beliefs. And I would just say one thing, just right to that in fact, a lot of the divisions that you read and hear about today, which are nominally religious, don't have a great deal of religious content. And when you read of riots in India of Sikhs versus Hindus, or nearer home, Catholics versus Protestants in Ireland, the degree of theological involvement concern of either of the parties is very much open to question. Sometimes, I think rather inaccurately, it's been called tribal. but I think it often of no greater significance than the sort of passions involved between workers and football teams, and workers who are receiving in of all sorts of hurts and slights and problems sometimes hang on to real or imagined identities as defence mechanisms, as armour, as hope, and so on and so forth. The fact is that there will be no solution of problems of workers while they do still see themselves as Protestants and Catholics and Jews and what have you. So, one, we're talking about a problem that certain reality that certainly will carry over into socialism. Religion isn't one that I accept could carry over into socialism, so far as the majority of people are concerned, because obviously socialism won't ban or can't ban of its nature, won't punish or bring indignities upon people who might go into a socialist society still with religious beliefs. But we won't have socialism if there aren't a majority of people who, in the process of becoming conscious socialists, won't have relinquished religious beliefs.
Yeah, I think that ties up, if I may sort of continue the same sort of discussion, with what you said almost as you started, and that was that there had been an apparently paradoxical growth of smaller and smaller nationalism as capitalism had spread wider and introduced more and more uniformity across the globe. And I think these last remarks you were making about sort of football team mentality religion seems to be a general attitude that capitalism has encouraged, and we can go into the reasons for that, of a certain type of chauvinism, of the need of workers within capitalism to have some sort of group identity, and the main core of it to be antagonism to those outside, or to specific outsiders. That seems to me the bulk of much of the nationalism within the British Isles. And one of the things it seems to have offset, which I think was a hangover from earlier ages, was an interest in other people's differences, an attraction towards difference because of its novelty, because of the things one learnt from it, which I would expect myself to re-emerge within socialism. Whereas at the moment within capitalism, because of the other pressures upon workers, differences as such are a matter for opposition and a matter for attacking somebody. Now, that seems to me to be all of a pattern of what capitalism has generated.
Just very briefly, I'd say this, that those breakings up into small areas, whilst I said that they were a reflection of capitalist needs, they didn't fail to touch upon important realities, even if the reality was distorted to a significant extent. And the nationalist movements, though I think is a true generalisation to say that they have served the needs of developing capitalism, a local capitalism expressing a nationalism in resistance to a metropolitan, an external capitalism, their very strength, and they have been very powerful and strong movements, has been because they've been able to touch upon matters of very deep concern to millions of people, and they've been able to get support in that way. And in fact, at times I've felt we as socialists have underestimated both the reality of those feelings, and because we have been rightly opposed to the motives of those who've been harnessing those feelings, we've at times rejected as not acceptable the feelings themselves. So that, for example, when we see a new nationalist movement arguing for new frontiers, we've said, this won't solve any workers' problems, there'll be new flags and new prison governors and new postage stamps, but you as workers will go on being exploited by working for wages and providing profits for you and so on and so forth. Well, that's true. But the extent to which people feel that the survival of what they speak, and there are not that many of them around these days, but the survival of Welsh is of importance, and it's threatened as they see it by the values of advertising of British capitalism on the TV and all the influences that can have, are, I think, valid concerns. So, yes, there is a very similar, great similarity with the football mentality, in the sense that so many of these divisions were arbitrary anyway. But of course, there was some important reality which the capitalists, for their own purposes, and apologists for capitalism, had harnessed for alien objectives. It's one other thing I would say about football is, of course, that is one of the things which is a characteristic thing of the world capitalist culture. How, for example, we may have set up Czechoslovakia and Romania and Austria and Hungary all out of what had been a previous unit, the Austrian Empire. But the workers of Budapest and of Vienna and of Belgrade are all passionately supporters of the same cultural phenomenon of football. And TV and Coca-Cola and Hollywood films and so on and so forth are reminders of the amazing extent, contrary you might see to that other process, of the uniformity trend of capitalist culture. But certainly the example of a football team support is doubly significant, precisely because I think football is very much a phenomenon of capitalist culture. I hope I'm not offending any fans in saying that. I'm a bit biased, I know. The reason was that I spent the first 12 years of my life within 200 yards of Tottenham Hotspur football ground, and it inoculated me for life.
Yes. I think that a lot of what you said is very interesting, but you basically just in the last few minutes, some very dangerous things have been said. And they actually were reflected in some discussions we had in the pub, and two lots of separate discussions I've heard. It's basically one of the major reasons I'm not a member of your party. If I was asked to be, I would not. Because it's this problem of equating Northern Ireland, for instance, with the irrelevance of the football is a very, very dangerous thing. Suggesting that it's of no significance to the workers of Zimbabwe, whether they're controlled by Smith or by the British government through the Colonial Office or by Mugabe, is of no importance. All these things are very dangerous nonsense, I think. And it's a matter of degree and extent, I grant you, underneath and are the same processes of capitalist exploitation wherever you're looking at. But it's a very essential matter of degree and extent, which is actually measured in large numbers of people's lives, in immense suffering, in working hours, in wage rates, in rents, in medical facilities and everything. And it's also measured just in terms of your ability to think ideologically. So I would like to say just one or two things quickly, which is that when looking at the map, it's very important to drive home the natures you have of the Soviet Union. Russians are a minority in the Soviet Union. It's often sort of equated, the two are equated. Russians are actually a minority. Racism, frankly, I think, is run on a very sophisticated and elaborate basis, where it's really white Russians, Caucasians, who are running the show. And your Slantai people are just not getting in on the action. People from the southern part are not getting in on it. But if you're looking at the map, it is very important to think about when you're in a situation. And, this is a problem I have with your party. It's that you're quite good at describing what has been or what's wrong and so on, and where you'd like to be, but there's this big gap in between about where you go and how you proceed in an intervening period. It's fine for us here in Britain, but if you were in Zimbabwe or something, and someone comes knocking on your door with gunshot wounds, and you happen to be a doctor or something, you've got to make up your mind. Are you going to support this person who's obviously been sort of engaged in a nationalist revolution against the white regime? I'm talking about when they were fighting the war against Smith. Or are you not? Are you going, because the law says you've got to inform the authorities? It's questions like that. You can't get out of it. You can get out of it here in England and just say, well, your workers go and have a socialist revolution. The fact is, the person, whoever it is beaten to death or something, needs attention. Now, I'd like to say that also it's a matter of conceiving how you really must have vocal people doing what is inevitably going to have to be done in any society I can ever conceive of, which is some kind of policing. It's hopefully going to be, you know, reflecting the desires of the majority on as decentralized basis as possible, a democratic thing which includes all age groups, both sexes, and so on. But it's something which is sorted out by local people. We have the whole issue of local policing in London. It's very important. And, you know, when you have cops from the south of Italy going to sort them out in the north, or when you have, you know, all these kind of situations, you get much more violence, you get much more distortion on the part of the authorities being able to distort the struggle about what's going on. And it's no coincidence that the Irish Rangers, for instance, the Irish Guards, the Irish Guards, the one British regiment that will not be sent to Northern Ireland, they're sent everywhere else. The British have reasons to go. There are not many reasons nowadays to go. But they're not sent to Northern Ireland. Why? Because they're bloody recruited there. I mean, they'll be, in the past they've been sent to India and everywhere, you know, but not to Ireland. And, I mean, I could gabble on for a long time, and I'm sure I shouldn't, but what I'm trying to say is any situation which involves troops from thousands of miles away coming in to sort the situation out is wrong. And therefore, we must think, in practical terms, about this gap between where we are now and where we want to be in the future. How are we going to proceed? We must, I think, support local, what is broadly termed nationalist revolutions. Think of it in terms of decentralization. If it's in the Soviet Union, great. If it's in the States, great. If it's in India, great. Because until you do that, you cannot even begin to talk socialist politics. It's not a matter of, you know, until the whites got out of administrative power in Zambia. And even today, you know, socialist politics in Zambia is still hardly anywhere. They can still point south and blame most of the problems they have on conspiracies by the apartheid regime in South Africa or, you know, in Afghanistan. If you're a socialist and you want socialism there, the first thing to do is to see the Russians out. Because until they go, the emergent working class, such as it is in Afghanistan, is going to blame. I mean, those are not bought off by the Communist Party structure and so on, but in the factories, but those are not bought off, are going to blame all their problems on the Russians. And you can't start the hell of your socialist politics until they go, these troops from thousands of miles away from up and all over the Soviet Union that are coming in. And I'm sorry to go on rather long, but it's very, very important. And only then that can you start to argue, you know, once it's come down like it has in Kenya now, after all the years from Kenyan independence and the mile events and so on, you know, only now are they beginning to get a socialist opposition that's getting interned in prison, tortured and so on. But they're beginning to see that Kenyatta is just a load of shit, which, if you'll excuse the expression, and actually he did use the tribal basis very much to get into power, but I agree with you, used it cynically.
You covered a lot of ground, and I won't attempt to cover it as well, because we go over time. But in a nutshell, you are saying that the fact that we, as socialists, reject nationalism and the national struggle is an error on our part, or... I'm glad that you have seen it as a crucial area, but I regard it, our rejection and opposition to it, as essential. It's interesting that the instances you've given, I think, go to uphold the very point I was making. The only significance of Zimbabwe, otherwise until recently known as Rhodesia, and in a sense better known as Rhodesia, I'm not talking, I don't have any sympathy, don't get me wrong, with the imposition by an alien imperial power of its power and its names. But in a sense, Rhodesia better reflects the reality that continues, now it's called Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is a name from a local African language. Rhodesia was imposed from the outside. But the continuity is the arbitrariness of what the Rhodes, working for British imperialism, managed to grab. Now, precisely because of its newness, Zimbabwe and Zambia, which has been going a little longer, just to the north, what otherwise used to be known as Northern Rhodesia, their existence as
administrative areas is arbitrary. And the language, let's say the Shona language, is neither spoken by all Zimbabweans nor confined to Zimbabwe. So in other words, Shona is spoken outside of Zimbabwe and not by everybody within Zimbabwe. And if frontiers, and God forbid that I should want to propose new ones, if you'd excuse the expression, if we were in the business of drawing new or proposed frontiers, any proposal you might have of existing other frontiers, I could draw different frontiers on different criteria. But oddly enough, if I was using the alleged criteria of the national movements, the frontiers would be very different to the way they actually are. And it's very interesting that however brotherly and passionately associated the neighbouring nationalist movements are, have you ever heard any suggestion that now that we have both, we Zimbabweans and we Zambians have both won our freedom at slightly different dates from British imperialism, we now sort it all out so that all the people who speak Shona will at least come under the same education authority because it will be so much more practical. Or we don't have, for practical purposes, any medical textbooks in Shona. In fact, we probably don't have any anything beyond grade 6 reading primers in Shona. So administratively, that difficult task would be a lot easier if there was one outfit doing it. But there won't be one outfit doing it because there's no such intention of rationalising these newly freed, in inverted commas, states on the lines which their nationalist leaderships say were the grounds for their becoming independent states. I would also mention to you that Mugabe, who claims to be a Marxist, and I must say, as people claiming to be Marxists in the Third World go, he's pretty a lot more shrewd on the distortions and cynicism of the Russian dictatorship's claim to be Marxist than any others. A lot more so, it would seem, than his rival, Nkomo. And it's worth bearing in mind that your suggestion that there's something about Mugabe that we should necessarily support, well, on the same criteria, there's something about Nkomo that we would necessarily support. But they don't support each other. And they are indicating that you don't have to have troops coming from thousands of miles away for the results to be just as uncomfortable. If you're somebody being shot at with napalm or with nice old-fashioned guns or whatever it is, it's not too consequential, I would say, whether they're from thousands of miles away or from down the road in Matabele land, or down the road from the Falls Road as against from Glasgow or Manchester or Devon or wherever the troops are sent from. No, the problem is not troops from a long way away, it's troops. The problem is not napalm from a long way away, it's napalm. And the circumstances in which these are used is by rival power groups trying to put themselves in the saddle. Now, the fact that the working class hasn't evolved very sharply and clearly in many of these countries doesn't alter the fact that the interest of workers is to go beyond these differences which are used by their rulers and would-be rulers to divide them. It doesn't mean to say that workers should ignore those differences. They're real differences. But the way those differences are used by would-be rulers and actual rulers to divide the workers, that is something that we've got to be on our guard against. And if you have sensed in the Socialist Party that we are opposed and hostile to the division of the working class into illusory attachments to particular real or proposed state areas of the new ruling class, if you sense that we're opposed to that, I'm very pleased that we've got through in that regard at least. And I would ask you to consider how you imagine that workers who see themselves as hostile on these sort of grounds can ever find the unity necessary to enable us to have the diversity and freedom that socialism involves. To get that unity, you're going to have a common recognition of what binds us together as workers and what outweighs in our thinking
the differences that real or imagined that we've had. Just one final point. It's worth bearing in mind, you mentioned Russian racism. Well, that's perhaps an exaggeration, but it's certainly true that the ruling elite of the Russian Empire are largely Russian. Though it doesn't become any nicer when they bring in somebody from Azerbaijan, as Andropov did the next day he was in power. You know, the boot of Moscow, the heel of the Moscow won't become any softer because Andropov has brought in an Azerbaijani. But nevertheless, it is certainly true that there is a considerable correlation between the Russian ruling class and the ruling class in Moscow, and they're Russian, or at least they're Russian and Ukrainian. But it doesn't also say either that the vast majority of the workers of Russia and Ukraine are exploited along with the workers from elsewhere. So it isn't essentially national division. The thing that is overriding in the Russian Empire, like every other part of capitalism, is the class difference, which doesn't obscure all other differences or negate them, but overrides them. And that is the point we try to emphasize.
Well, since time's getting on, I think we'd better take those last three contributions indicated. Clifford, then Pottis, and then Peter.
Help me out there if you'd like to.
Okay, Clifford, you're next.
Is to me a very attractive and realistic one. I mean, I would say that at the moment, it doesn't happen very often, but it's quite possible for anybody to speak several languages fluently under the right conditions. That if a young person, say 3 or 4 years old, if you spend a third year in one country, your fourth year in another, and your fifth year in a third, and then just be staying in that third country for the rest of your life, nevertheless, you would remain perfectly trilingual in your life. And I see no reason why it shouldn't happen. Of course, people sometimes argue that some people are better linguists than others, but I think this is rather a myth we suffer from at the moment. In fact, one of the most natural abilities that absolutely everybody's got is language, simply because we know that we can all speak. And if we couldn't speak English, there's no reason why we couldn't all speak French or German or no language.
Yes, I go along with that. Though, incidentally, sometimes the more educated, perhaps I should say trained, or you are in one language, it's sometimes I can think of interesting cases quite near to home where it can actually be a block to the attainment of another language. Your very fluency and literacy in a particular language can be a block, if only a psychological one, to the attainment of another language. But it's not always a question, by the way, of our needing socialism to learn lots of different languages. Sometimes people who in present conditions know a lot of different languages, sometimes the problem will be becoming literate in the several languages that people at the moment are illiterate in. You do get cases, interesting parts of the world, where people are illiterate in three different languages. I would also say it's often a question of attitude. On my one visit to Israel, I was intrigued by the fact that whereas your garbage collector and your bus conductor could speak about just about everything, so whichever angle you approached him in, whether it was Romanian or Polish or French or whatever, you'd probably find he was with you. But your intellectual elite, at least, rather pride themselves on the fact they don't know anything but Hebrew. That's one of the consequences of modern nationalism. So sometimes these ideological things can lead to actual qualitative disadvantages. Actually, people are proud of the fact that they only know Hebrew, whereas your common or garden worker would know Arabic and several others. So, yes, I do believe that there are... I don't believe you could begin to explain the difficulty that English people are noted for having in learning other languages in psychological or medical or cultural terms. It would clearly have to be explained in the overhang of an imperial mentality. So that the reason why English people, on the whole, are noted for their lesser speed of learning other languages than, say, Swedes isn't something psychological or biological or anything of that kind, but is the fact that Sweden didn't have an empire and Britain did, and Swedes don't go around and never got used to the idea that every civilised person has got to speak Swedish. They soon got used to the idea that you've got to learn it because nobody's going to learn Swedish. So there are important influences on even whether we can or we can't learn languages, which are overhangs which we're not always aware of. Worth bearing in mind, we're not always aware of the extent to which we, even revolutionary socialists that we are, can be influenced by the fact we happen to be revolutionary socialists who've grown up in England with an overhang of imperial attitudes that we may unconsciously have absorbed, and so on.
Peter.
Yes, Nathan. It never ceases to amaze me the illogicality of the views you hear expressed. For example, the idea that we have a friend here that you can do away with nationalism by actually taking up nationalist causes is obviously an absurd contradiction in terms. And such things inevitably bring you into violent conflict between workers, and we're actually killing your fellow members of the working class. And this is not simply something for the future or anything like this. It has an immediate impact now, because if you're a socialist, you don't take up and get involved with nationalist causes, which means that at least there are some people around who are not doing this sort of thing. And the more socialist you get, the less workers will be killing each other for these quite obvious reasons. And it's very nice of that, and I'm sure we're all grateful for it. He's not going to join the Socialist Party.
You invited me yesterday.
Let me assure you in advance that with the present views you've got, you stand absolutely no chance of being admitted to membership. You'll be because they are totally hostile to socialist principles or any kind of practical or logical reasons for actually putting together a better world where workers and the community can enjoy a common interest. I only mention that by way of an aside. As another aside, briefly, and as a bit of a heresy, can I just say this? That it has struck me for some time that there is nothing about an individual holding a particular religious idea. I know that religion is divisive and all that sort of thing, and I don't want to diminish that, but there is nothing about a person holding a particular religious idea which necessarily prevents that person from engaging with other people on the basis of common ownership of the means of production, cooperating to produce wealth for human need. Just throw that in by way of a heresy. Anyway, what I was really going to mention is this, that it seems to me, in the concepts that we've been working with, carrying on the discussion from yesterday with this idea about decentralized cooperation, that what we were stressing there was the importance of local community, and I was suggesting that we should see that as the basis, the basic unit of social organization. And this detracts from the existing and present emphasis on nations, nationalities. You get away from the national concept and you get much more down to this smaller local concept of local community. I think there are good reasons why we should do that, because I think there are sort of boundaries within which or beyond which individuals, in terms of both distance and concentrations of people, you know, you just can't find an identity. It's all right in theory to talk about an identity of an individual with a common world interest. But that is a very, very far-flung, abstract sort of notion. And in practical terms, you can identify with what happens, you know, in your own locality, get involved with the problems of your own locality, then you can get involved with the petty problems of some local community on the other side of the world, and not some that aren't important reasons, you know, to which they're not linked. So I think this thing about local community as the basic unit of social organization is a practical one and desirable one for a whole range of reasons. Also suggested that it was a very, very adaptable system because it is organised through these various spheres for different purposes. What I had in mind then, because I don't know nearly as much as what was it probably about, this whole history of the impact of the development of modern capitalism on cultural diversity. What I had in mind were mainly the factors of production, I must admit. And it struck me that that sort of structure was a very, very practical one in relation to production of wealth, local production. You can see that certain things, local food production, for example, local food consumption, you can see that other things are very, very important. Transport systems, very, very difficult to think of those in a purely local context. So you've got to think on a wider sphere, a regional sphere. You can't think of energy supply on a local concept. That's totally impossible. So you've got to think of energy supply, I would suggest, in a much wider world sphere. So this was a very, very flexible system, it seemed to me, for all the factors which relate to production. But it's now suggested to me, what Bart says, that this is also a very flexible system and very much suits the situation that we have, the way he's described it, which is actually the result of this very, very complex history of cultural diversity. And it seems to me this organisation is one which can be adapted to this very, very complex theme of cultural diversity.
Well, one thing I was attempting to do, Peter has reiterated the phrase local community, which he used yesterday, and he's just indicated that he saw that I was trying to make the point this morning that whilst I wasn't in any sense disagreeing with him, one must be cognizant of the fact that there isn't some agreed, measurable entity, local community, and we all know what we're talking about. I mean, in our own quite recent past, we are here in the local community of the London Borough of Islington. There's nothing natural about that. At least there were people much opposed at the time in the London Borough of Islington being made out of the pre-existing borough of Finsbury being lumped together with the pre-existing Islington, made the London Borough of Islington, and there are still home rule for Finsbury movement. I mention that because here are two administrative units and on local government lines, but you know, there's not something so natural about them. Everybody knows what you mean or is agreed as to what they should be. In our Declaration of Principles, we speak of the capture of machinery of government, national and local. But it's worth bearing in mind, I don't want to give a disproportionate emphasis to this, that precisely because we have agreed, and I indicated, and you obviously are not in disagreement, that there are not only different levels of area and control, but there are functional differences as well. Now, the particular ones we're referring to in local government are administrative ones, yet you have given particular emphasis when you're speaking in terms of regions, of regions in the sense of economic realities. But in terms of economic realities, it doesn't necessarily follow that the local government's areas which have evolved are particularly appropriate to the operation of socialism as distinct from workplace structures, which of course have no historical place in the development of political democracy in British capitalism, but of course are not unfamiliar to us in notions like workers' councils and the whole syndicalist movement. I would say, without wanting to be in any way dogmatic about it, that I wouldn't rule out that in the evolution of socialist structures, as we make a change from capitalism, that local government would not be the only structure that we would use and adapt, and that the trade union structure, particularly because of its direct connections with economic activities and direct connections with the growth and struggle of the working class movement, shouldn't be ignored. I won't go further than that. Shouldn't be ignored as potential structures which may take on functions within a socialist society. As to the heretical thought that you threw in about people with religious beliefs playing their part in socialism, I've never doubted that in a socialist society, the fact that there might be people with religious beliefs would hinder their full and valid participation in socialist society. It is not on those grounds, I believe, that the Socialist Party rightly says that no one subscribing to religious beliefs is admissible to our party. It is not that we reject such people with religious beliefs from joining the Socialist Party because we don't think they can play a part in a socialist society when we get it. I've never worried on that score. The reason why the Socialist Party has to, I believe it correctly has this position, reject the admission into our ranks of people with religious beliefs is not connected with the extent to which they will or will not be able to contribute to a socialist society when established. It is that their very religious beliefs are an important factor in standing in the way of our obtaining a socialist society. Because I think that while working men and women still see socialism merely as a beautiful dream, if they see it at all, and don't have the recognition and awareness that socialism isn't merely another nostrum, another dream put forward by the dream mongers to people to consume or not as they see fit, but is a theory, is a program, is a concept which has been shaped out of a materialist understanding of the process of social development. And that from that understanding of social development as it's already taken place, we can see the shape of things to come out of the process of development. And that it is an understanding, therefore, of that materialist analysis of historical development, social development, that our beautiful dream, and I don't say it isn't a beautiful dream, and I have no quarrel with beautiful dreams, It is what converts our beautiful dream to a serious and practical and scientific proposal for our next step. And if people are trying and holding to the views which offer other than material and rational explanations of social change and change of people and change of habits and change of society, I think that stands in the way of what is necessary for the bringing into being of the society by people who understand the processes which make it practical. It's in that sense that we reject the religious views. But I well remember years ago, it was always sad. It saddened me anyway. I used to go out for the party and speak in Nottingham from time to time, and there was a most sympathetic husband and wife from Wales. They found themselves somewhere. I think they're probably school teachers. That would probably explain a lot. You could get school teachers in Wales and all sorts of funny places, and they were in Nottingham. And they were very, very sympathetic to socialism. Very sympathetic indeed. I would say, come the day, we have them as full participants in the socialist community. But they were dedicated Catholics. And they were a little intrigued, I must say, at my sympathetic assessment of why it was so understandable for Welsh people to be Catholics. That they were not unaware that their Catholicism had been adopted as a kind of reaction against the loss, not of Merry England, but of Merry Wales, of the Wales that they look back with, medieval Wales with a certain attraction before the brutality of capitalism came on the scene. And because Protestantism and the chapel and all that was so clearly identified with the Wales that they rejected, I could rather sympathetically see the role of their Catholicism. And they were rather interested, because it had never been brought to their attention before, the extent to which our own movement was greatly enriched by William Morris, who was not unlinked with a similar reaction to the ugliness of Victorian society and the Pre-Raphaelites, who were artists reacting against the brutality and inhumanity of Victorian industrialism. In the best end, ended up with a William Morris formulating his socialist ideas, but in another aspect were to lead to the Oxford movement, Newman, and the return to Catholicism. So even the insights that my particular interest in that field I was able to give to those two devout Christians, I was in a sense able to bring them nearer to the party, but at the same time I was to make their difficulties worse, because at that stage they nevertheless were attached to their religious beliefs. But I do believe that, and they were aware of it, remained an important barrier, and I think a barrier that is a needful barrier.